This is the worst podcast I've ever been on.
These guys are shit. It's true.
This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
From the L-shaped studios in Ho Ho Loon Plaza in beautiful and serene Vancouver, British Columbia, the hard-traveling fanboys present to you Arrow Month.
Welcome, Place to Be Nation listeners. Fastest 2 minutes in a comic book.
Jesus Christ. We are the hard-traveling fanboys. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to another episode, holiday-themed episode, because we are on the same week as the new year beginning. It's a brand new year. I am Greg Phillips. He is Nick Duke. We are coming to you.
That was Greg doing Chris Berman, which if you are already annoyed with that, you should probably just go ahead and turn the podcast off.
Yeah. I mean, it's pretty good. It's pretty good. But Philip Rivers,
But as you can tell, we're having a great time here in the studio in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada, in beautiful Ho Ho Loon Plaza. The grass is green. The skies are blue. It's beautiful here, and we are, of course, the longest-running weekly episodic comic book podcast in all of Place to Be Nation.
I had a mental, I just was convinced you were going to swap to Chris Berman speak halfway through that.
Nonetheless, I'm Greg Phillips, he's Nick Duke, and we are kicking off Arrow Month, but because it's us, and because we're hearing noises from strange places right now, because it is the week of New Year's, we're tired. We've had a long, busy week. I've had a long week of travel myself, and so we're going to bring you an abbreviated episode. But we're going to kick off something we're really excited about: Arrow Month here at the Hard Traveling Fanboys. Yes, this is the month, the last month of shows of episodes of our beloved CW show Arrow, something that I believe first hit the airwaves in 2012 and really proved to be one of our favorite live-action comic book shows of all time. And unfortunately, it's wrapping up its run this month, and so we're going to give you an entire month of content dedicated to the show and the various peaks along the way of this show. And we decided to kick this off with a countdown of our favorite episodes of Arrow. And this is something, Nick, that we actually visited for the first time way back when we were but young cub columnists at PlaceToBeNation.com. We'd counted down our five favorite Arrow episodes up through the season 3 mid-season finale. This was way back in 2015, I believe.
God.
And
those numbers don't add up, but whatever.
They're maybe 2014.
Yeah, that sounds more
like
it.
But nonetheless, we did this, and now we have come all these years later, gosh, almost 5 years later, we have come to this point where we are now ready to count down our favorite episodes of the entirety of Arrow, with the exception, of course, of whatever is to come on the back part of this season. So,
which is 3 more episodes, I think. They have 2 episodes airing when they come back, and then one, like, little, what they've described as kind of an epilogue, so.
Yeah. And if they nail it, who knows? The epilogue could take its place in the Pantheon. But for now, we're going to count down our favorites up to this point in Arrow. And it's a show, Nick, that, we'll be talking about it more in depth throughout the month when we have more time. But it's a show that certainly has meant a lot to us and has created a fandom that has lasted through 8 seasons, which is remarkable.
Yeah, and spawned really what seems like the bulk of the CW's programming slate now.
Yes.
I mean, Flash, Supergirl, Legends of Tomorrow, Batwoman, Black Lightning, the future Green Arrow and the Canaries spinoff show, the Superman and Lois show, numerous animated properties that are on CW Seed. Lots of different ways that this has influenced not just our fandoms, but many other fandoms as well. And we've been consistent throughout. I think a lot of people, as the Arrowverse has expanded, have found different shows. Flash, predominantly, who has kind of taken over the mantle for a lot of people as their favorite of the CW shows. But we've always kind of been right there with Arrow. It has been the one that when it's right, when it's on, when it's at its best, I'm always going to prefer its method of storytelling to any other the CW does. And so this was excruciatingly hard to narrow down to just five episodes. I went back, of course, and looked at the countdown we did all those years ago to kind of get an idea of where my head was at then. Reviewed all the synopses on Wikipedia for the episodes. Didn't get a chance to rewatch them because that would have taken too much time. But yeah, it was tough. I probably had a list of 25 or 30 that I could have considered, and then you know had to cut that to five.
Yes, very similar for me, Nick. I did the same thing you did, reading the Wikipedia summaries. We just didn't have time to rewatch all the episodes, but it just showed it demonstrated to me that when the show is on, it's still my favorite of the superhero shows. It has knocked it out of the park so many times that I could have easily filled this list with 20 strong episodes that will be contenders for the best. And even when I was putting this list together, my top three was even a little cut above all of those other great episodes that almost made the list. And it was really like splitting hairs between those top three episodes. So should be a fun countdown. I suspect we'll have some similarities on our lists, perhaps not parallels, but we'll have to see which seasons are most represented. I think I'd know the answers to that, but we're going to find out here in just a moment. So I think I started us off last week, Nick. So do you want to start us off this week?
If you insist. So, like I said, going back and looking at the list we had previously, that gave me some ideas, but then also reading the synopses, and I was reminded when reading these of an episode that I didn't include back then that was from season two, and yet now, and in hindsight, I'm going to throw it on here at number five. Perhaps a little bit of a, you know, reactionary move after being reminded of it via the synopsis, but I'm going to go with episode 15 of season two. This would be The Promise. This is an episode that Arrow has always maintained that dual narrative using both the flashbacks or the flash forwards in recent years and the modern storyline to, you know, kind of reflect each other, to tell a story in tandem, to provide more context for what's happening in the modern day. And this was the one of the flashbacks where the shit kind of hit the fan on Leanne Yu. This was where we saw what caused the dissolution of Oliver and Slade's friendship. This is where we see the death of Shadow on Leanne Yu during the battle aboard the Amazo with Dr. Ivo over, you know, as they're trying to gain control of the Mirakuru serum. Meanwhile, in the present day, you've got Slade, who has arrived in Star City and has revealed himself to Oliver as still being alive and being there, and who is there under the auspices of a normal business meeting with Moira Queen, so Oliver can't just, you know, flat out attack him without revealing himself. And so you have Slade walking around Oliver's family home with Oliver's family while Oliver is standing there knowing everything that has happened between the two, and most notably knowing the promise that Slade made to him all those years ago that he was going to basically destroy Oliver's life, take away everyone he ever loved, to the point where Oliver would consider his own death to be a mercy by the time it was all over. And you have that ultimate reveal at the end. Meanwhile, you've got Diggle and Roy who are trying to get into the mansion to take down Slade quietly, and Slade is just outmaneuvering them at every turn, but doing so silently and cunningly in a way that no one is the wiser. It really is just an episode that highlights why, in my opinion, Slade Wilson from Season 2 is still, despite some tough competition from a couple of years ago, the greatest of all the Arrow villains. And this one just gets across that menace, and it's a great, great acting job by Manu Bennett and, of course, Stephen Amell as well.
Yeah, it was a great representation of that season, and really of all of the best seasons of Arrow, which mm-hmm. are the most personal seasons.
Right.
The seasons that involve personal stakes rather than necessarily world-changing stakes. And in this case, it's about revenge, a simple story of revenge, which we would see play out in, again, the best seasons of Arrow are the ones that are typically rooted in a villain out for revenge. And certainly it would set the stage for some of the many great episodes that were to follow in season two. So, to kick things off on my list, I am going to go all the way to season five of Arrow, and I'm going to go to the finale of that season. And it's an episode titled Leon Yu. Now, Leon Yu is a term that means a great deal to anybody that is familiar with the Arrowverse because it is where it all began. It's where Oliver Queen was stranded, the island where he was gone for 5 years and became someone else, became something else. And in this episode, Leon Yu, it is the grand finale to what turned into one of the best seasons of the show in that it featured Adrian Chase, a.k.a. Prometheus, offering Oliver Queen a true, final resolution to their conflict. And so Adrian has uncovered the fact that Oliver has a long-lost son named William, and he has kidnapped William. And also, along with the Black Siren, has kidnapped all of Oliver's friends and is holding them hostages. So Oliver, with his back against the wall, has to do something he never thought he would do, and he has to team up with some of his greatest villains. He actually teams up with Malcolm Merlyn, Nissa Al Ghul, Digger Harkness, and Slade Wilson,
mm-hmm.
who he is forced to free and hope that he has truly changed in the time that he has been on Leon Yu imprisoned. It results in a huge knockdown, drag-out fight, as you would expect in Arrow. It would it would create this huge conflict between the two teams. Comes down to Arrow versus Prometheus, as you would expect. And in typical great Arrow episode fashion, this will be a recurring theme. I find myself most attracted to the episodes that put our hero through the worst possible ringer imaginable. And in this case, this episode ends with seemingly everyone Oliver knows dying.
Yes. it's unfair to the episode, but I have to admit, my perception of it's a bit colored by the following season's premiere, which essentially reveals that
hand-waved a lot.
Everyone who was important managed to survive. The only notable death was
Malcolm.
And the mother of William's mother, yeah.
Yeah.
So,
but yeah, so it is a shock moment that you don't see coming where there's also the fact that Oliver makes the decision in this episode not to kill Adrian Chase. And it's a huge character moment for Oliver, who's gone full circle over the course of this season. And then in that moment when he decides to spare Chase's life, Chase takes his own life, and in doing so triggers the bomb that destroys Leon Yu, which figuratively and literally tears apart the foundation of the show. So huge episode from that standpoint. And that's not to completely hand wave the end, which is something I forgot until I was reading the recap of this, that it also ends the flashbacks on the show because it wraps up the confrontation between Oliver and Konstantin Kovar, and who's played brilliantly by Dolph Lundgren, and it brings to an end that conflict, which had played out in the flashbacks, which gives us a great action scene there, too. So you get the classic great Arrow action. You get incredible performances from Josh Segarra as Prometheus, who, if Deathstroke is the one on the show, then Prometheus is the 1A on the villains of this show.
Yeah, for sure.
And it seems like what you couldn't get any further from this in escalation for the show because it was so personal. And yet, as great as this episode was, it may not have even been the best episode from that season. So
yeah, we'll discuss that later. But moving on to my number four, I am going to go to season seven, and we talk about how a lot of these episodes are Oliver being put through the emotional ringer, being put through even sometimes a physical ringer. But being tortured, being suffering for our entertainment, essentially. And I think there are often episodes that do that on a one or two episode arc, but there was never an extended period of time that they did that was as long as the first seven episodes of season seven, which saw Oliver imprisoned in Slabside Penitentiary. And as great as those seven episodes were, I had to have some representation from that on my list. And so I had to have Oliver overcoming that. And so I went with season seven's episode seven. That is the Slabside Redemption, where we kind of see all the prison stuff play out and culminate here. We get to see the redemption of Turner, Black, or what's it, Bronze Tiger. Yes, who turns on Brick and Cody Rhodes, who I've forgotten the name of. I think it's Derek Sampson, but played by Cody Rhodes, and helps Oliver in his attempt to protect his family by taking out Ricardo Diaz. Ricardo Diaz has come to Slabside with the intention of killing Oliver Queen before hunting down Felicity and William, and Oliver knows this is his chance. He has to stop him here, and so you get these great confrontations as a prison riot breaks out. You get Bronze Tiger up against Brick and Derek Sampson. You get Oliver and Ricardo Diaz playing out what to that point had been. You could make the argument, I guess, that that storyline really didn't pick up until the Caden James fake out at the previous midseason. But really, Ricardo Diaz had been around for a season and a half then. It was kind of the first character or villain who had stretched across multiple seasons without a true payoff in the show's history. And here you finally get that. And you get some payoff for the Stanley Dover character who had been super annoying to that point. But yet, it kind of all comes full circle. It pays off here in this one. But predominantly, the biggest thing you get in this episode is one of the most emotional reunions in the show's history as Oliver is reunited at the end with both Felicity and Diggle. Which just goes to show, we love to see this character be tortured and go through the ringer, but he has to come out on the other side. Yep. And this episode of the show gives you that. And again, had to have some representation from that outstanding prison storyline. So Slabside Redemption is my number four.
Yes, an excellent choice, and I will have more to say on it a little bit later. My next episode, my number four episode, comes to us from season two, and it is simply titled, appropriately enough, Deathstroke. This is an episode where the totality of Slade Wilson's plan really becomes apparent. And again, it's another in a series of episodes that'll be on my list where things are not going well for our hero. And in this case, it is it starts with Slade kidnapping Thea, Oliver's sister, which leads Oliver to make the decision to make his colleague, Isabel Roshev, the temporary CEO of Queen Consolidated, his company that was owned by his father, that had been built into this major empire, the biggest thing in Star City, Starling City at the time. And he uses this time off to reconcile with Moira. Well, while he's doing that, Isabel Roshev immediately uses her power to convince the board of directors to make her the permanent CEO of Queen Consolidated, taking over full control of the company. Then Oliver finds out, confronts her, and realizes he's been tricked the whole time, that she's been working with Slade and was just an operative of Slade's this entire time. So Slade has taken Oliver's family company from him. He's taken his sister. Turns out his sister was only kidnapped as a distraction to free prisoners for Deathstroke to build his army. But in the process, told Thea that her dad is Malcolm Merlyn, something that both Oliver and Moira had kept from her. This drives a wedge between Oliver and his sister and his mother. This then leads to Roy leaving Starling City as a result of what's going on with Thea and her being driven away. Quentin Lance is arrested for aiding the Arrow, which wipes out another one of Oliver's allies. Then, to top it off, Slade tells Laurel that Oliver is the Arrow, something he's kept from her for the entirety of the show. So we also get a flashback of what ends up happening at the end of Slade's time with Oliver back in Leon U. It is an episode that is all about the totality of Slade Wilson's plan and how brilliant he is as a tactician. He has taken out everybody that matters to Oliver. Everyone is driven away from him. He has no supporters left, no allies left except Diggle and Felicity. And, you know, it's sort of a divide and then conquer plan for Slade. I know there are several episodes I could have thrown in from this arc, but this one stood out to me as one that really dealt with the emotional damage that can be done to a character rather than the physical damage. So big fan of this episode at number four.
Absolutely. Moving on to another season two episode, number three on my list. This is one that finished, I believe, second or third in whenever we did this several years ago on my list. And that is the season two episode. Season two is the only season on my list that gets multiple entries. And that is the episode Seeing Red. Now, based on the title, you would think this would have to be a predominantly Roy Harper episode. And while Roy Harper does feature as it tells the story of his becoming unhinged after being injected with the Mirakuru serum, he isn't really necessarily the focus. Because the focus here in this episode is really, this is the episode that sums up who Moira Queen was as a character on the show. We both remember how in season one, we kind of hated Moira. We didn't really find her relatable. We didn't really understand what she added to the show. And slowly over the course of season two, she came into her own as a character, and this episode highlights that better than any. It's set against the backdrop of she's running for, I believe, a city council seat or perhaps a mayoral seat, I don't remember, against Sebastian Blood. Mm-hmm. And she has decided that no one's going to vote for her because of all of the terrible things that the Queen family has done have come to light, and she's going to drop out of the race. And this episode really gets to the heart of she and Oliver's relationship because it shows Oliver, who is looking out for his mother, trying to encourage her, trying to lift her up, getting her to her resolve back up to continue on in the fight against Sebastian Blood. And in the course of all that, we get flashbacks that reveal just what lengths she went to long ago to protect Oliver. As we see Oliver's one-night stand, William's mother, who we referenced when talking about Leanne, the episode Leanne U., we see basically the origins of William, the secret origin of William in this episode, as this one night stand that Oliver has turns up pregnant, and Moira sets her up financially and essentially pays her off to go away so that her son's future can be uninterrupted. It's a morally questionable action. It's one that should, if it was mishandled, would make you hate the character. Mm-hmm. But really, it just gets across how much she loves her son and what lengths she's willing to go to do that, because she knows he is too immature to be a father at that point. But in the present day, we get that little bit of closure on that point, because she reveals after Oliver gives her the courage to continue in the mayoral fight, we see her tell Oliver, I've known since you came back that you're the Arrow, and I'm proud of the man you've become. And it really is a beautiful way of bringing their relationship full circle. And it would be a great way to end the episode if that were the way they ended the episode. Because as soon as he and his mother have had this breakthrough moment where they're closer than they've ever been since Oliver's return from the island, they're going home, and Slade intercepts their limo and takes Moira outside the limo and in front of Oliver and Thea, puts a blade through her chest and murders her, bringing, you know, essentially fulfilling the first part of his promise as Moira has been killed.
And also giving Oliver that terrible Sophie's Choice.
Mm-hmm. Of Moira or Thea, I believe. Mm-hmm. And it was just, that was the moment where the Deathstroke conflict went to another level. It was already great, and then it went to like all-time comic book adaptation level at that point. So throw in the Roy stuff, throw in a great scene that has Laurel revealing to Oliver that Slade told her that he was the Green Arrow. And really, it is, in my opinion, the best episode of season two, which is the best season of the show, in my estimation.
Excellent pick, Nick. Excellent pick. And it was one that was in consideration for my episode, choice as well. My number three is one that you've already talked about, actually. And it's one from the incredible prison story arc from season seven, that the first half of season seven, that was one of, we agreed, was perhaps the best seven episode stretch of the series. It was the Slabside Redemption. It was the culmination of this. Frankly, several episodes from this run could have been on there, but ultimately, this was the best of the bunch. This was, and this was really the realization, I think, of what we wanted that arc to be, which was Oliver in prison. And in fact, if those episodes had any weaknesses, they involved the parts that weren't about Oliver in prison. So it was all focused on Oliver and his struggle in Slabside Penitentiary as he finally has the reckoning against Ricardo Diaz, who has put Oliver through absolute hell. And this episode involves some of the best fight scenes ever on Arrow. Maybe the best fight scenes ever on Arrow. Certainly, at least since maybe season one. Some incredible fights here throughout. And it also features, you know, an incredible performance from Michael J. White as Bronze Tiger. It also features what I think is a killer performance by Ricardo Diaz. And I apologize, I can't remember the actor's name at the moment, but he's great. I loved, I know that villain is divisive online. I love the Ricardo Diaz character, even though his story went on probably too long. I thought it was a great way to tie it up here. The physical toll that Oliver has been put through, the creepy serial killer who we thought was just a harmless sidekick for most of this run, Oliver finally sees his true colors, and is teased for future appearances. It's just an outstanding episode with a great physical conflict and a great resolution that feels true to the character, that feels appropriate for what's happened. And then, of course, that great reunion at the end. I remember when we watched this at the time, talking about it that next day, I think I made the remark that if you were to make an Arrow movie, that would be a perfect ending. Like, if they had done the Supermax movie they were planning on years ago, that ending with them kind of staring out at the sunset was just beautiful, idyllic, almost reminded me of the ending of Enter the Dragon. Really good stuff. This episode is one of my top three, and I think is completely worthy of being compared to these top two episodes. And honestly, it was splitting hairs between the next three episodes for me.
Yeah, obviously it made my list as well, and I have a good feeling that our top two are going to be the same in some order. Going back to that list we did all the way back in 2014, I remember the episode that finished number one on both our lists, we kind of probably could have been accused of some recency bias in that because it was the most recent episode that we had seen. It was the mid-season finale of season three. It was an episode entitled The Climb. And I don't know, after reviewing all these episodes, I still remember how great that episode was. Yep. So I'm going at number two with season three, episode nine's The Climb. This is the episode that shows us our first physical confrontation between Oliver and Ra's al Ghul after it had been building for the first eight episodes of season three, which, by the way, season three gets dumped on by a lot of people, and I think it's one of the stronger seasons of the eight in the show's history. It would be in the top half for me for sure.
No question.
But anyway, this one builds all throughout the episode. It's building tension as Oliver. We're being shown flash forwards of Oliver climbing this mountain. And eventually it's revealed that he's decided, in an effort to stop the League from murdering 50 people in Star City, he has decided that he's going to climb to the top of this mountain and face Ra's al Ghul in single combat, something that nobody has done for centuries, apparently. And in this episode, we often see Oliver lose fights. We had not to this point, nor would we ever again, see him lose a fight in such a one-sided, lopsided, one-handed fashion. Because Ra's al Ghul casually, dark side style, arms behind the back, beats the ever-loving hell out of Oliver. And at no point is it ever close. In that original column, we made the comparison to that year's Brock Lesnar versus John Cena SummerSlam match, where you keep waiting for the hope spot that the babyface is going to make his miraculous comeback.
And it never happens.
And the twist of the fight is the hope spot never comes. It is pure domination from beginning to end that ends with Ra's impaling Oliver and throwing him off the side of the cliff, which is something at the time was mind-blowing and is still, even in hindsight, knowing how they got out of it, still, in terms of tension, one of the most well put together episodes they've ever crafted. Because
one of the greatest cliffhangers in recent television history that I can remember.
Yes, because we genuinely had no idea how they were going to get out of it. All throughout the episode, too, you kind of got the sense that Oliver knows this might be happening, that he might lose, because he's having these moments with Felicity, or these moments with Laurel, or these moments with Quentin, and the whole thing just has this foreboding
sense of dread. Like a man on death row.
Right.
He's walking to his final confrontation, and he knows it's going to be his final confrontation.
Exactly. So, yeah, all these years later, I still think this is an outstanding episode. Matt Nable, who played Ra's al Ghul, was outstanding in that season. Gets slept on a lot. So, yeah, man, I'm sticking with this. I'm going The Climb at number two.
Also, lost in a lot of memories, this was also the first official Oliver and Felicity hookup. The first, like, official.
I think that was later in season three.
I thought this was in that episode because she sneaks into his quarters.
I think that's later in season three. You're thinking of the one where he finally agrees to take on the leadership of the league.
Oh, okay.
And so he's going to stay in Nanda Parbat.
And then he ends up marrying
Yanissa.
Yep.
Right.
Okay, yep. This episode is so freaking great. So freaking great. So great, in fact, that I have to wait to talk about it.
Oh, man.
It's splitting hairs with the next one.
Right.
Because honestly, I had this one ranked first earlier, and I flip-flopped him twice during the course of coming up with my list over the course of about a half hour earlier today. But I'm going to go with my number two, which I suspect is probably going to be your number one. And honestly, most days it might be mine. Today I was just taken by this by The Climb. But my number two episode comes to us from season five, and it is called, work with me here, Capuchon. I don't know if
Capuchon.
I said that. Capuchon.
As Anatoly says it,
yes. Yeah. And Capuchon is an episode that, you know, I already mentioned the finale from this season earlier. This is the 17th episode of that season. And it takes place largely in flashback, but what has happened in the present day is that Oliver has been taken prisoner and chained up by Prometheus, who he now knows is Adrian Chase. And in the flashbacks, we're finding out the resolution to a sort of loose thread that had been introduced all the way back in season one, which is how Oliver got his Bratva tattoo. That was something mentioned in a very early episode in season one where, you know, it's brought up that he has this tattoo that allows him to work with the Bratva, this Russian gang, essentially. And in the flashbacks, we find out how he gets this. And it comes about through his confrontation with Konstantin Kovar, which at the time we think is his final confrontation with Konstantin Kovar, leads to an incredible fight scene between them and Oliver ultimately ignoring the warnings of his friend Anatoly and killing Konstantin Kovar, which earns him his Bratva tattoo. Of course, Kovar is not quite as dead as we all think. But the real reason that this episode makes my list, although that stuff's great, the
yes.
flashback stuff is outstanding in this episode.
Right.
It ties together so many threads that we had wondered about from the earliest days of the show. But the real reason this makes my list is aforementioned chained up Oliver at the behest of Adrian Chase. And Chase is trying not to kill Oliver Queen because he easily could at this point. This is one of the first times in the show where we've seen Oliver in a situation where the bad guy could easily kill him and doesn't, and it makes perfect sense why he doesn't.
Right.
Because for Adrian Chase, this is not simply about killing Oliver Queen. This is about killing everything that he stands for. This is about proving to Oliver Queen that Oliver is the villain of the story, that Oliver is the monster here that killed his father, that killed so many other people's fathers. And it's all about him trying to psychologically break Oliver through every means possible and get Oliver to admit that at his heart, he's a stone-cold killer and that's all he'll ever be. And this is an episode that launched 1,000 memes because the big moment in the episode, of course, is Oliver, who has been tricked by his former ally, Evelyn Sharp, who he initially thought was part of his team, then thought she was a traitor, then thought she had been redeemed, perhaps, or had some sort of heart about her. Adrian Chase walks up to Oliver and casually breaks her neck in front of him, and Oliver finally sees the futility of everything that he's been doing, and it all culminates in Oliver shouting out, I killed them because I wanted to kill them, and I liked it.
Mm-hmm.
And that moment has broken Oliver. And of course he sees that Evelyn faked her death. And by this point, Oliver is spiritually broken in the same way that Bruce Wayne was in the build up to Nightfall.
Mm-hmm.
And at this point, Adrian no longer has to do anything physically to Oliver. He's beaten him. He lets him go. And just that's how little he thinks of him at this point. And indeed, the episode ends with Oliver Queen going to the team, Felicity and Diggle, and disbanding Team Arrow. There is no more Green Arrow at the end of this episode. And on top of that, I should mention as well, to tie this whole thing together, my favorite episodes, the top three episodes here, feel cinematic. And this one does as well, in that loose thread that I talked about earlier, the Bratva tattoo, Adrian Chase's last reminder of what he's done to Oliver is that he actually burns off the Bratva tattoo that Oliver had gotten all those years earlier. Mm-hmm. And it wraps up the theme of the episode so that it stands alone, but it also wraps up really the theme of all of these years of flashbacks that have been going on. He has basically removed this identity that Oliver had built for himself. Just a brilliant episode with one, I would say, in my opinion, the all-time greatest villain performance in an episode by Adrian Chase in the show, which has a lot of competition, but it's just outstanding. This is Stephen Amell's finest hour, yes, as far as a performance goes. He is, if you were to submit one scene for an award, that would be it from this show. He was amazing. So yeah, I can't say enough about this. Probably should have been my number one, honestly, but I'll get into my reasons for going with my number one pick in just a minute.
Yeah, and without further ado, it is my number one pick. And number one is, of course, Capuchon. That is episode 17 of season 5, for all the reasons Greg just said. But to boil it down, it's what you closed on. It is in a show where it would be so easy to lose the focus of the show, as other shows have done. I think The Flash is guilty of often losing the idea that buries the focus, mm-hmm, of the show. And Arrow has been guilty of that as well, mm-hmm, whether it was the reliance on Team Arrow there for a little while season or what six, have you. Yep. This episode highlights that when it's at its best, Oliver is front and center. And in this episode, Stephen Amell gives, to date, his best performance in the show's history. Yep. Maybe there's something that's going to top it in the last three episodes. I don't know. But Stephen Amell knocks it out of the park. Josh Segar knocks it out of the park. And really, in a show that's about, you know, a superhero show about guys in costumes fighting each other, the most effective scene in the history of the show is two dudes standing in a room talking.
Yep.
And that is a credit to the 100%. Showrunners. It's a credit to the writers, whoever wrote those pieces of dialogue. And it's a credit to the emotional and physical journeys we had carried these characters through the first five seasons. So you said it perfectly. Capuchon, to me, number one episode in the show's history.
It was, it's so amazing. It's hard to even put it into words, because this was a pinnacle in many ways of the show. The show firing on all cylinders, acting wise, writing wise, and something that I'm torn on whether I would throw this out there as the episode to watch for somebody that's never watched the show before.
I don't think you can, because you have, like, if you don't have the prior 5 years, mm-hmm, you should have all five seasons, I think, of build up, but especially the 16 episodes of season 5 that precede it. If you don't understand who Prometheus is as a character, I don't think this
works as well.
Works as a standalone episode.
Yeah. And certainly,
if I were going to show somebody a standalone episode, it probably would be The Climb, because I think that story, you can understand that and get everything you need to out of it just in that 1 hour of television.
I would say if you have nothing else to do, binge season 1 of Arrow and then binge season 5, because those are really the two sequel seasons, I think, directly tied to one another. 1 and 2, obviously, as well. But those two seasons are so thematically similar in, mm-hmm, terms of the things that happen in season 1 directly inform what we see in season 5. But yeah, this episode is amazing. And without any further ado, my number one episode is one that Nick already talked about brilliantly, which is The Climb. And every reason that he mentioned for The Climb is true. What I ultimately went with, again, the three episodes that were top of my list were a cut above the rest, because they're the most cinematic episodes, I feel. Mm-hmm. And The Climb feels like the most, I don't know, because all three of these episodes I could say that about, Slabside, Capuchon, and this one, it feels like such a standalone entity, right, that over the course, yes, it had been built to, but over the course of an hour, or a little less than an hour, taking out commercials, you have a build, a promise, and a delivery of that promise. which is something that you really – how often in any form of our entertainment does the bad guy say something's going to happen and it happens exactly the way that he says it's going to happen?
In both of our top two episodes, The Climb and Capuchon is the same way.
Yep.
But just on an emotional level as opposed to a physical level.
Absolutely. We are so used to the hero is marching to his doom, and then at the very last possible second, he finds some rabbit to pull out of his hat, and he makes it. And in this case, no rabbit comes out of the hat. The hat gets torn up, kicked out of the ring.
You could make the argument that in the subsequent – the comeback, sure, that there is – and yeah, but we all – it's the nature of not just superhero television, but superhero stories in general. When they lose – there's not going to be permanence to it. And I think we all knew that at the time, but we didn't care.
Right.
You know?
And as an example, you won't find many episodes of Batman the Animated Series, unless they're a two-parter or something, that ends in that 20 minutes with Batman losing.
Right.
And that's what we get here.
Right.
This is, as you mentioned, John Cena, Brock Lesnar. This is Brock Lesnar telling John Cena he's going to beat him until he sweats and pukes and pisses and whatever, and doing it.
Yes.
And that's pretty much what happens here. And Oliver, as the lead character in this show, seems to know, as you mentioned, seems to have that feeling that he's not going to win. What I was reminded of as you were mentioning it was the scene in Tombstone when Wyatt Earp asked Doc Holliday at the end about Johnny Ringo, "I can't beat him, can I?" And Doc just can't even look him in the eyes, and it's pretty much and Wyatt knows I can't beat him, but I'm going to go and I'm going to face him anyway. And in the movie, of course, Doc Holliday intercepts and takes care of it for Wyatt. But this is like if Wyatt goes and he knows he can't beat this guy in a duel, and he's going to lose, he's going to die, and there's nothing he can do about it. Oliver faces it. He makes his amends with everybody that he knows and loves. And when he shows up in this fight, you still think, as you're watching this the first time, you're thinking, okay,
something's going to happen. I remember I thought maybe Nyssa was going to turn on Raish because she was up there on the top of the cliff with him.
Maybe shoot an arrow through him or something. Do something. Or Oliver is going to find some way during the fight to beat him. Or Raish is going to disarm him and not kill him.
Right.
And
show him. Or I remember even thinking, like, when he threw him over the cliff, that Oliver was going to, like, come back up somehow.
The climb.
Yeah.
But the climb is not about a literal, like, climb over the mountain. The climb is, well, it is the climb to get to the duel.
To get to the duel.
But it's also that, you know, climbing to your own doom.
Right.
The idea of you're going through this crucible, if you will, which was mentioned in as far back as season two.
Which was another episode I considered for my list.
And how do you face this? How does someone face their own demise, their own lack of ability to win? And this is something we have seen played out in comics, but not that often. I remember Nightfall, one of the stories coming out of that story was Bruce Wayne also having to face the fact that he lost.
Right.
Not just that he had his broken back.
Right.
But facing the fact that a man fought him and beat him.
Right.
And how does Oliver deal with this going forward? It was and to their credit, Arrow, I think, has done an amazing job with most of their mid-season finales of crafting these great cliffhangers. I remember the season four, even mid-season finale, has that cliffhanger with the sort of operatic scene, and then Oliver and Felicity get into the limo to go out on a date, and then Damian Dark's men riddle it with bullets and seemingly kills her at that point. So they have these great, but nothing has ever quite surpassed as far as a cliffhanger goes. Maybe you could argue the season five finale, but that feeling of seeing Oliver go over that cliff after, because when he gets stabbed, you're like, oh shit, he's probably going to die from the wound. But then he gets kicked off the damn cliff.
Right.
And it's like, things are bad
for
this man. So, the amazing, amazing episode. It's like a movie unto itself. Matt Nable gives a great performance, certainly worthy of the name Ra's al Ghul and all the great actors that have portrayed him in animation and live action. Can't say enough about this episode. Can't say enough about all these episodes.
Right.
But in particular, the top three on my list were just so cinematic. And like you said, I think anybody that wants to see the best of Arrow can watch these episodes, and particularly The Climb, because it does stand alone, I think. You don't need as much of the buildup to get it and to understand it. Maybe Slabside as well to a degree. But watch these episodes, and I think you'll get an idea of why so many people beloved this show. Are there bad episodes of Arrow? Certainly.
Yes.
But when the show is at its best, it's still the pinnacle of live-action superhero TV to me.
Yeah, absolutely. Real quick bonus countdown. I'm going to put you on the spot here. Rank the seasons.
Ooh.
Since we've talked about them so yes. much. To me, unquestionably, season four will be at the bottom.
Yes, absolutely.
That's the Damian Dark season.
The Damian Dark season. Even doing the research for this episode.
Yeah. I didn't consider a single episode.
I didn't either.
Like, I looked at it and I was like, and I was reading the synopsis thinking, this all sounds so awful. Like, just,
and it sounds so unlike Arrow.
Yes.
Because
that's the problem.
Yes. It felt like Arrow trying
to. If you did a comedic spin on that same story on, like, Legends of Tomorrow. Probably works.
Perfect example.
Yeah.
The season of Legends of Tomorrow that had Damian Dark in it, working with Reverse Flash and Malcolm Merlin was
outstanding.
Great.
Yep.
But it was also not self-serious. It was taking advantage of that show's strengths. And in the case of Arrow, the show's strengths are when it's grounded and, as we mentioned earlier, when it's personal.
Right.
And there was nothing less personal than watching Oliver try to battle with a magician.
I agree. So season four would be at the bottom. I would say season six,
probably
next.
It's
six or seven. To
yeah,
me.
And there,
but there's really good stuff in both of them. The problem is both of those seasons
have
instead of doing the season long arc that they had always done, mm-hmm. they split it into like half season stories. So the first half of season six is the Kate and James stuff, which sucks. And the back half of season six is the Ricardo Diaz stuff, which is great.
Yep.
Same thing with season seven. First half is the prison. Awesome.
Awesome.
And the second back half is Amico and who's the other one? I've forgotten the guy's name. Anyway,
yeah.
Bad. So I would say season six would be seventh on this hypothetical ranking, and season seven would be six. So I would say in reverse order, it's four. Six, seven.
If you could take the back half of season six and and we've said this before, the
right.
front half of season seven
and put them together as one long story,
you have the best season probably of Arrow, but or one of them certainly.
Yeah.
But I would probably agree with you. I'd probably tend to go six above, slightly below seven, just because
right.
seven does have the prison.
The prison,
it.
Right?
And I think some of the Amico stuff
works
really well.
Right?
They just did not stick the landing on it.
So four, six, seven is what we're in agreement.
Then you get into
this is where it gets tough.
Nut cutting time.
I was
counting eight.
I'm going to count eight to this point.
Okay.
It's hard.
Yeah.
I'm thinking one because we're down to one, two, three, five, and eight. Right.
That's
what's left.
Yep.
I would say season one.
I would probably agree with that. I'd say season one at that next spot there. And that's really because I thought the show.
And that makes it sound like we're hating on season one.
No, not at all.
But like every show, it takes it a little while to find itself.
Yep. Once season one found itself, probably about four episodes in, excellent.
Oh, yeah.
Excellent. In fact, there was one episode of season one that almost made my list, which was the one where he reveals to Tommy, where he reveals to Tommy that he is the Arrow at the end of it. Very great.
I considered the last episode, Sacrifice, where Tommy dies and all that stuff.
But yeah, so season one, I would be fine slotting there,
and then season eight.
I think eight
and one are really close. Yeah. I think by the time I am anticipating loving these last three episodes, so that's I'm kind of preemptively putting it there.
Yeah.
But I understand it's shortened, but the stories they've told thus far in season eight have enabled them to do things they've never done in the show's history.
Yes.
And it's one of the first times they're raising the stakes to like a cosmic or supernatural level. And it doesn't feel forced like it does with the Damian Dark stuff.
Yeah, and it's also given us because it's a combination.
Right,
you're elevating it to these cosmic stakes, but you're focusing in on the personal.
It really is kind of like Arrow's version of Endgame, because like in Avengers Endgame, they're making all these references and calling back to all these movies and all these events that we've put years of our lives into. And Arrow, this is the same way. We're revisiting all these characters and all these concepts and all these locations for what we know is the last
time.
And
it's taking it to an even bigger level of ridiculousness than what season four was, but it's doing it through the lens
of how this affects Oliver.
How this affects Oliver Queen and
right.
how personal and emotional this is to him. And it's just worked to this. It's been a great season to this point. So yeah, I'm good with this ahead of season one. And then we get into And, you know, honestly, I could even see myself putting 8 over 3.
Oh, I can't. I can't for number – I am a season 3 truther is what I call myself because people hate on that season. Matt Nable is outstanding as Ra's al Ghul.
Yes, he is.
Giving us, I would argue, probably the most comic book accurate version of the character we've ever seen in live action. Because, in the movies, we've only had like Liam Neeson's character, yeah. Who's very – it's a take, but it's not – it doesn't have the grandiose, you know, yes. feel about it, all the trappings of the League of Assassins that we get on Arrow right. here. But also, season 3, you got to remember, is the season where the Oliver-Felicity relationship that you either True. Love or you hate,
and we love it,
comes into its own, really comes into its own. Season 3 also gives us Ray Palmer for the first time in True. The Arrowverse.
Yeah.
Season 3 gives us The Climb. Season 3 gives us so many great things. The Thea Malcolm relationship
yep.
that has that Corder Maltese episode early in season 3.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So, like, season 3 to me, if you're doing this in, like, gaps, I think the top two seasons are up here.
The Death of Sarah is in that season.
Yep. Then there's a gap, and there's season 3, and I think there's a gap between season 3 and everything else.
I'll have to wait and see how season 8 wraps up. It's going to be interesting to watch because I can see myself elevating 8 above 3, but 3 is great. And I think 3 is so woefully underrated by people because
it had to follow 2. I mean, yeah. like, nothing
was going
to
follow.
Was going to follow 2. Yeah.
And they could not have followed 2 with 5 because 5 doesn't work without all the build-up right. to it from years prior.
I almost wish that 4, the Damian Dark stuff had come first, so people might have appreciated 3 more in hindsight.
Right.
But, yeah, I'm going with 3 at 3. And then
you get into the big two.
And you can debate this. For me, as much as I love both seasons, I feel very strongly about which one I prefer. And I would say season 5 would be second.
Two. And then putting season 2.
Put season 2 at the top.
It's interesting because I haven't seen season 2 since it was coming on live, but I remember.
So, like, 3 months ago, I was up in the middle of the night for no reason. I don't remember what I was doing, and they were showing it in syndication on TNT or something. Mm. And I caught it, and I was like, this is still. Like, the Seeing Red episode where he kills Moira Queen. I didn't watch it all the way through, but I was watching the episode. I was like, this is still just. Right. I mean, so good. And really, like, no one could have seen. Like, the show, even in season 1, was really good.
Yep.
But no one could have seen it going from the level that season 1 was to what we got in season 2 yeah. that quickly. It became like one of the best superhero television shows, if not the best season of superhero television we've ever seen.
Yeah.
Right away in season 2.
And paid off because it actively committed to paying off things from season 1
right.
that would have been easy to leave behind. The Deathstroke mask on the island, they could have left that. Right.
Or saved it. Too long. Yeah. Waited too long. Yeah. You know?
And instead, they embraced it. They embraced, like, the Suicide Squad.
I read an interview with either Guggenheim or Berlanti, I can't remember, where they said one of them had either worked on Lost or knew somebody who worked on Lost, and they said one of the things that we learned from Lost was if you have questions you need to answer or things you need to pay off, don't fall into the trap of waiting too long to answer those questions or pay those things off. Because if your characters are strong and your audience is willing to go with you, you can always find new questions to ask mm-hmm. and new things to set up later. And season 2 is a great example of that. But that's not to sell 5. I mean, they're both outstanding, and and it's interesting because they're so similar. And I think that's what we love about yep. them is it's the two most personal conflicts Oliver ever faced.
Yeah, the two best villains.
And to me, the fact that two... Deathstroke's conflict is a little bit more personal, puts it over the top, as far as I'm concerned.
That's very fair. I think I would, as of now, before going back to rewatch season 2, I would probably flip-flop them and have 2 slightly at number 2 and 5 at number 1. So, all the great things you just said about season 2, completely accurate. And I want to go back and rewatch it, in fact. Really, I want to rewatch the whole show from the beginning.
Yeah, I would like to.
Because season 2 took superhero television to a new... As much as I love Smallville, and I really did love that show, there was never a season of Smallville that approaches season 2 of Arrow. Not even close to it. But I think season 5, for me, for a couple of different reasons. Number 1, we had just come from season 4.
Yes.
Which... Which left bad taste.
Left bad taste in mouth.
Yes. And honestly, put us both in a position where we were on shaky footing going into that season of like, is this show going to survive?
We thought the show was done. Like, we knew that the writers always talked about a 5-year plan, the 5-year flashback plan. And so we were convinced coming into season 5, based off the just how bad season 4 was. And it's tough to, like, I love the show, but season 4 is bad.
Yeah.
It's really, really bad. I thought the show was done. Like, I thought, we're going to do this season. I hope they pay everything off. And they had a great run. 100 episodes. We never would have thought we'd get 100 episodes.
Yeah.
And not only did they redeem themselves, they gave us what wound up being like one of right the two there best with season seasons. 2.
Yep.
Yeah.
And
it really rejuvenated the show. Without season 5, they don't get to make 6, 7, and 8. Because they had to find whatever it was going to be to get the audience reinvested. And this worked.
The new thread. Yeah. They had to do a couple things. They had to refocus on Oliver Queen as the main character of the show. They got away from that a little bit in season 4.
And then got away from
it again later on.
Season 6. But
they had to give us a new reason to care about Oliver Queen, because we had seemingly seen him go full circle from vigilante to superhero.
Right.
Bright colors.
Beating magic magicians.
Comic book costume and all that. This was getting back to the roots. This introduced
back to basics.
A new element that I thought was really interesting of Mayor Oliver Queen, which brought to the mind in the audience, how long can he maintain a secret identity if he's the mayor of Star City? And it also brought back a personal villain that had a personal tie to Oliver Queen, similar to what we saw with Deathstroke. It gave us it brought us back to ground level hand-to-hand action combat on screen, which for me is a big deal, because that was one of the draws of Arrow early on, was they had the best fight scenes on television in those early seasons. It brought those back to mind, and it gave us an emotional journey for the hero to go through over the course of the season that was torturous for the audience, but also made you feel empathy for Oliver Queen again, something that kind of got lost in the silliness of season 4. And on top of all that, it gives us this sweeping villain who takes us through all these twists and turns that it felt like every week new layers were evolving of who Prometheus is. And we think the vigilante is going to be the villain perhaps of the season or whatever, and Prometheus ends up being the villain. Prometheus and Vigilante, who is their identity? We think Adrian Chase is the Vigilante.
Right.
Because of the comic book tie, the Vigilante ends up being someone totally different, which gets pushed off to the next season, I believe.
No, they pay it off in that same season.
Oh, that's
just
right.
It's not
important to the ultimate plot. He's ultimately
red herring.
A red herring. And Prometheus is the bad guy. He is Adrian Chase. And then finding out who is Adrian Chase? Why is Adrian Chase coming after Oliver? And to find out that it all ties back to the beginning of the show, and everything that happens in this season is ultimately the result of the actions of Oliver Queen earlier in the show. Such an amazing season, such an emotional season. And so for that reason, it gets my number one spot very slightly over 2. Really, those are the 2 cut above seasons, 3, 8, 1. 7, 6, and then of course 4 at the very bottom.
Absolutely. So you know, we differ on you. Ultimately, I think are keeping 3 ahead of 8.
Yes,
and then we differ on the top 2. But other than that, same.
Yep. Well, with that being said, folks, we want to see your list. What are your favorite Arrow episodes? What are your favorite Arrow seasons? Let us know on Twitter at gphillips8652, at nickduke87. Let us know on the Place to Be Nation Comics Facebook page, assuming I remember to share the episode this week, which is something I've been failing to do for a long time now, due to time constraints. But that being said, I do want to, before we sign off on this abbreviated episode, I wanted to drop a couple quick thoughts, which number one, I have finished Doomsday Clock number 12, the epic finale of the Geoff Johns, Gary Frank comic book series. I will not spoil anything. Nick hasn't finished it yet. He's going to read it all as one when he can. He landed it again. Geoff Johns delivered another gem. One of the best comic book issues I've read all year, which I said about issue 10 as well, I think. But issue 12 is certainly one of the best comic book issues I've read in years. Well, okay, let me extend it farther back than that. In a long time, since the DC Rebirth special. And it's a love letter to DC Comics, a love letter to Superman, and a love letter to DC Comics. So yeah, big fan of that book and what Johns does with these characters. And one thing that I feel like we have to do, let's get our brief thoughts.
Oh God.
On Star Wars. Everybody's weighing in, Nick. I mean,
I weigh in. I had my Podblast series on.
Yes, tell us more.
So I had the Marathon Podblast series where I went to Orlando, Florida and watched all 9 Star Wars films. All 9 episodes of the Skywalker saga in a 27-hour period. I've seen Rise of Skywalker. I liked Rise of Skywalker. I'm the wrong person to come to and expect any sort of outrage or hatred as it relates to Star Wars. I'm the person who defends the prequels. I'm the person who, like, it's hard for me to come up with any piece of Star Wars related media, whether it be books, comics, video games, anything that I've just outright hated. I liked this. I was entertained by it. Was it great? No. But J.J. Abrams knows enough about me as a Star Wars fan to know there's bits of low-hanging fruit everywhere that he can just reach down and pluck and punch me in the stomach emotionally. And it works.
What are you saying? Oh, God. Are you saying it's pretty good?
It's pretty good. I mean, it's pretty good is the way I would sum up this entire sequel trilogy. It's pretty good.
You just landed on what I'm like, going to say. Yep.
And here's the controversial part that I know Todd will cringe at. This sequel trilogy never hits the lows that the prequels does. But it also never hits the highs that episode 3 does. So to me, the original trilogy are still the kings. Actually, I'd probably put episode 3 ahead of A New Hope, which is like the most hot take thing ever as far as Star Wars fans are related. And then to me, the sequel trilogy is like almost in this inseparable lump. I would say as of this moment, I would probably have Rise of Skywalker as the top movie in that trilogy. But that's a really – I don't have any great passion for that opinion.
I figured you'd have Last Jedi as the top of it.
Those two are neck and neck. Force Awakens is my least favorite of the trilogy. I'll put it that way. And they're ahead of episode 1 and 2.
Always interested to get your thoughts, Nick, because you are the Star Wars aficionado. I'm a huge fan of Star Wars. I consider myself anyway. I've loved – I was telling you this story earlier, Nick, and this is a true story. I have never left a theater after a Star Wars movie thinking, God, I hated that.
Yeah.
Not once. The only time I ever left the theater thinking that wasn't awesome was Last Jedi.
It was Last Jedi, yeah.
And that was just where I was kind of confused of how I thought about it.
Which is weird because of these 3 sequel trilogy movies, the only one I walked out of going, oh my God, that was amazing, was The Force Awakens. And every time I've seen it since then, I've enjoyed it a little less. Last Jedi, every time I've seen it, I've enjoyed it a little more. And I'm looking forward to seeing how Rise of Skywalker ages. I've only seen it the once, which was at the marathon screening, when I've been awake for 27 hours or more than that. So I really need to see it again with fresh eyes and reevaluate how I feel about it. But like I said, on first viewing, I think it's a really good movie. I think it's a good movie, and I think it's, I guess, my favorite of the sequel trilogy. But this sequel trilogy in general doesn't engender passionate feelings from me either.
I agree.
Way.
I said the way I put it to you and some of our friends online in a chat group that we're in is I realize a lot of I liked Rise of Skywalker. First of all, I put it out there. I thought I enjoyed myself. I understand. Was it a perfect movie? Not even close to a perfect movie. I don't even think it was a great movie by any means, but I enjoyed myself at the movie. And yes, there were gaping plot holes. There were things that didn't make sense, but guess what? That's in almost every Star Wars movie.
Yes.
Ultimately, I had to ask myself, did I enjoy myself? And yes, and I came out of it mostly satisfied with the character arcs in the movie of the characters that they introduced in The Force Awakens. I thought they gave them some form of finality and completion, which is more than I could ask for, I suppose, in this situation, or all that I could ask for, rather. I'm like you, that I think, but what I realized was a lot of the critiques of this movie are that it's fan service. But ultimately, this entire sequel series was just about fan service.
With the exception of The Last Jedi, which kind of the problem that a lot of people had with it is that it didn't take these characters in directions that people either expected or demanded to see. Right. People wanted to see like Luke Skywalker as this Superman-like figure, badass, I think. Yeah. Like, where he was unbeatable physically, untouchable emotionally, and had no flaws. Had come through the events of Return of the Jedi unscathed, unflawed, immaculate, essentially. Yes.
And quite honestly, as I've said from the get-go, I've had an issue from a Star Wars fan perspective of a kid. I never read the Extended Universe books or any of that crap. Just from somebody that watched the original movies and loved them, I had a huge issue with this whole franchise from the get-go, because it felt from the very moment that Force Awakens begins as if it was just redoing all the stuff that we had already seen. Empire versus Rebels, Dark Lord with a mysterious apprentice or master that we don't know much about, farmer on a
family has turned.
Family has turned.
Member of the family has turned.
Farmer on a desert planet.
Right.
Rogue pilot.
Right. Yep.
You know,
which is really my biggest issue with Force Awakens. I think you can make the strong argument from a pacing and plotting perspective that Force Awakens is probably the best of those.
Yeah.
But the plot and the story it's seeking to tell is so direct.
Well, and the very characters they introduced are so rooted in the characters of the original.
Of episode 4, really.
Yeah.
And like, you and I discussed this offline a while ago, and this is going to turn into a Star Wars podcast, but like, you can hate the prequels, and I totally respect your decision to hate the prequels if you choose to do that.
Yes.
What you can't sit there and say is that episode 1 and 2, and even episode 3, are trying to tell you versions of the stories that you saw in episodes 4, 5, and 6.
For better or for worse,
they are telling their own original story with original locations, original characters, and original motifs. You can't really say that about this sequel trilogy, with perhaps the exception of The Last Jedi.
What I've said many times about all three of these movies, all three of these are better, objectively, better made movies. Well, you could argue Rise of Skywalker in this, but I would argue that still all three of these movies are better made movies than the prequel trilogy in terms of, like, if you're just looking at beginning, middle,
technical aspects,
pacing, etc. However,
Last Jedi is still, like, if you're looking at it strictly from a technical standpoint, visuals, Last Jedi is probably the best looking Star Wars movie.
It's one of the best looking movies of all time.
Yeah, it's amazing.
But while the technical aspects of these movies is undoubtedly superior to what we saw in the technical filmmaking even that we saw in the prequels, the one thing that the prequels have that these movies don't have in great abundance is imagination.
Yep.
And that's something, and frankly, it's hard for anybody to top the imagination of George Lucas. You can make fun of his writing, his pacing.
With good reason.
With good reason, absolutely. The guy does not write dialogue well. But what he does do is have an imagination that none of us can probably even approach.
Right.
So, and that's something that inherently, going into Rise of Skywalker, from my perspective, I already have lowered expectations for this franchise. Not that I haven't loved it. I love The Force Awakens. I just recently rushed the TV, liked it more than I liked it in the theater, actually. Last Jedi, as much as I criticized it, is still fun to watch because it's visually stunning, and there's some really cool character moments from Luke Skywalker, Mark Hamill, in that movie.
If you take out, and I hesitate to say this because we could get into a whole other podcast on this. Star Wars has become a political issue, and I don't understand it, and I don't like it. The character of Rose Tico in particular has become a political issue for people.
Yes.
And I'm not saying this because I have an issue with her character. I'm saying this because I have an issue with like how the predominant subplot in that movie throws off the pacing of the movie. Mm-hmm. If you could remove the Canto Bight sequence from that movie, which by the way, Last Jedi is the longest Star Wars movie ever made, you could stand to cut 15, 20 minutes from that thing.
Easily.
That movie becomes a lot better.
Yes.
A lot better. And I forget where I was going with this, but like, it just, I don't know. There are things about this entire sequel trilogy that just have felt rushed in a way, which is weird because they've taken time in between each film.
Which is the same case of the prequels, oddly enough.
And as much as I like Last Jedi, and I do like Last Jedi a great deal, I think Rise of Skywalker would have been a better movie had J.J. Abrams just stuck around and done the whole thing.
I agree. Yeah,
because he is actively going out of his way throughout Rise of Skywalker to try and swerve around most of the events of Last Jedi, which is fine. That's his narrative choice. But in that case, if you don't want that to be the middle story in the trilogy, make your own version.
And why did it begs the question, why did Disney allow The Last Jedi to be made if they – we've talked about this with Iron Man 3 from Marvel,
right,
to be fair. Why did you allow this movie to be made this way if you did not intend for this to be the director?
So, originally, the idea of the sequel trilogy was that each one was going to be directed by a different director, much the same way the original trilogy was.
Yes,
you know, each one was directed by a different director: George Lucas, Irvin Kershner, and Richard Marquand. But
that story was all George Lucas.
Well, it was all George Lucas. And that's what this sequel trilogy and really the Star Wars franchise under Disney has lacked. As much as I've enjoyed a lot of the movies, Solo being the only one that I would classify as anything close to a misfire, and I still enjoyed the movie, Kathleen Kennedy has not exerted the same level of creative control over the Star Wars franchise in terms of the stories that are being told the way that Kevin Feige does at Marvel.
Mm-hmm.
Great respect to anybody who directs a Marvel movie, anybody who writes a Marvel movie, but there is nothing that happens in a Marvel movie that does not happen without the express consent of Kevin Feige, who sees this larger picture at play.
Mm-hmm.
Star Wars needs that. The original idea was J.J. was going to tell his story, and then Rian Johnson was going to pick up the threads from J.J.'s story that he found interesting and spin them in his own way, and then he was going to hand it off to Colin Trevorrow, who was Jurassic World and what was that movie? The indie movie, Safety Not Guaranteed, the time travel. I think it's a time travel movie. Anyway, and the idea was each one of them was going to be able to pick up and kind of riff on the previous film.
Right.
When you dismiss Colin Trevorrow for whatever reason that wound up happening, and bring JJ back. Now, JJ inevitably is wanting to pick up on threads from his movie that have been altered in the middle trilogy, and it winds up feeling like this Rise of Skywalker feels like a sequel to Force Awakens that is also trying to ignore the fact that a sequel to Force Awakens has already been made. And it leads to the whole sequel trilogy feeling very disjointed.
And I argued that about Last Jedi, that it felt to me obvious that this was not where they were going in Force Awakens, and that Rian Johnson was doing his own thing. And I thought it felt odd there, but it certainly feels that way in Rise of Skywalker, where you're right, it is completely ignoring. I would argue that Rian Johnson, to a degree, ignored some of the hints, and especially having recently rewatched Force Awakens.
Right.
But at the same time, this movie does that in major degree to The Last Jedi. And it hurt it as much as... Now, again, I liked The Rise of Skywalker. I was entertained by it.
Right.
But I do think, to your point, it hurts the movie because you're having to cram so much into it.
The Rise of Skywalker has to be so many things. It has to be a sequel to The Last Jedi. It has to be a sequel to The Force Awakens. It has to be, foolishly, I think, Disney's attempt at, quote, bringing the entire Skywalker saga to a close, which it never should have been. It should have just been bringing this sequel trilogy to a close. And it also is having to be almost J.J. Abrams doing both his version of Episode 8 and his version of Episode 9
right.
in one movie. To the point where Chris Terrio, who helped write the film, even said that they actually asked Disney back in January if they could alter the release plans and release it as Episode 9 Part 1 and Episode 9 Part 2. Because J.J. Abrams had a cut of the movie that was like 3.5 hours long.
Did we ever get that
cut? And he wanted to keep everything. No.
You don't think so?
No.
We'll never get that cut.
No, I don't think so.
Why?
No alternate cut of any Star Wars movie currently exists in an easy-to-find format.
I've often, and I don't know...
Like, George Lucas and Disney, they're now complicit in this decision, has effectively replaced the original cuts with the special editions and have no indications they're going to release those movies.
And
Phil Lord and Chris Miller, I think, or is it Chris Lord and Phil Miller? I don't remember. The Lord Miller guys, we're never going to see their cut of Solo. We're never going to see the original Gareth Edwards cut of Rogue One, which was reworked by, I think it was Terry Gilliam. That's the other thing Disney's got to get under control. There has been, with the exception of Force Awakens, there has been director and creative shakeup on literally every Star Wars movie they've released.
Now,
It's interesting because I've always been curious. We talked about Russian Twitch. We've talked as much as we both love Episode 3 and both think it's one of the best Star Wars movies. The argument can be made that some of the things that happened there are rushed because of all the time that was spent in the first two movies on other stuff.
Right,
because
George Lucas altered the original plan for the prequels was essentially what we actually got in Episode 1 and 2 would have been one movie. That would have been Episode 1. Mm. Episode 2, we would have seen The Clone Wars, which has been adapted very well in an animated series from what I understand and what I've seen of it. I have not finished it yet. And then Episode 3 would essentially be what we got, but with a little, you wouldn't have had as much to do in Episode 3 because a lot of it would have been
and you probably
seated could have, in Episode 2.
And you would have had a chance to see Anakin and Obi-Wan as friends and colleagues and all that. But the interesting thing is I've often wondered the script of Episode 3 is different from the actual movie that we get. It's longer and it's got more stuff in it. And I always wondered if George Lucas shot that and just has never released the footage.
That's a possibility.
You know, like stuff that's in the video game that's not in the movie.
The novelization as well. Yeah. That adds a little bit more context to it. Yeah.
But anyway, it's just a recurring thing. But I would say overall, to get back to the original point of bringing this up, I liked Rise of Skywalker.
I did too.
There were story directions in that I kind of cringed at because it was stuff from the old extended universe that I didn't really necessarily want to see brought over.
What's an example?
Well, I'm trying to dance around it a little bit, but some of the stuff, and this isn't too much of a spoiler because it's in the trailer, but the stuff involving Palpatine, some of it was a little, fan fiction-y.
There's a particular plot device used in the expanded universe that they didn't use
here. They didn't, and I'm glad
I was, yeah. That's like, and while I understand what you're saying, as I think I texted you after the movie, or maybe it was Greg Rossino, I can't remember, like, while I agree it was a bit hokey, I am never going to complain
about more
Ian McDiarmid as Emperor Palpatine, who, by the way, was outstanding.
Yes, he and Anthony Daniels as C-3PO were my favorite parts of that movie.
And I would say she's been good in the entire sequel trilogy.
But Daisy Ridley,
Really good in this movie. She comes into her own as Rey in this movie, and Adam Driver is really good as Kylo Ren too. That's the sad thing is the sequel trilogy has a disjointed feel, and there is a core there with those two characters that you could have done something. Not that this wasn't good, it was, but it could have been great.
Right, and regarding Ian McDiarmid, I have come to this conclusion long ago that he damn it, Nick, he might be my favorite Star Wars character, which is wild.
In terms of like characters that you like to. You're not rooting for the character. Empathizing with him, but he is infinitely interesting and makes anything he's in better.
He is Vince McMahon
in
from 1998 to 2008 or whatever. He is this. If you've heard us talk about Mr. McMahon, he is just he's so evil
incarnate,
cartoonishly evil, but in a good way. Like, it's entertaining to watch. And Ian McDiarmid, with every cackle, with every all-knowing, vague description
of
something.
With every quiver of every jowl
hanging there. He's just the most evil sumbitch that ever did live.
Yep.
And God dang it, now I want Stone Cold versus Palpatine in a movie.
Drop his ass with a stutter.
Convulsing with lightning shooting everywhere.
He tries to zap Austin with the lightning, and Austin kicks out at two.
No, don't attack me. I'm just an old man. Unlimited power.
Greg's neighbors are going to hate us.
I don't give a shit.
I liked Rise of Skywalker. Controversially, I'll give this, since this is an episode of Countdown. I'll close it with this. For me,
We're about to get super controversial.
We're
going to
get super controversial, but I'm going to do it. And are we going to include? We're going to include Rogue One and Solo in this, or no?
That's your call.
I'll include them in true Countdown fashion.
I have seen Solo.
We'll go bottom to top. Episode 1 at the bottom. Mm. Solo would be 10th. Episode 2 would be 9th. Force Awakens would be 8th. Last Jedi would be 7th. Rise of Skywalker would be 6th. A New Hope would be 5th.
Well, good luck.
Revenge of the Sith would be fourth. Rogue One would be third. Empire Strikes Back would be second. Return of the Jedi, still to this day, not just my favorite Star Wars movie, but probably among my favorite 5 to 10 movies of all time.
Yub nub. At the bottom, and I've wavered on this a few times, and I need to rewatch both of them back to back to determine for sure. But I would.
The debate comes down to: are you valuing consistency or the highs?
Yeah,
and if you're valuing the highs, it's not close.
Yes.
If you're valuing consistency, it's not close.
Yes, episode one would be at the bottom of my list, even though it has one of the two best lightsaber duels of all time, in my opinion, that we've seen in the Duel of the Fates.
That's better.
I like Anakin versus Obi-Wan.
That's pretty damn good. Yeah, that's the only one I would accept.
Yeah,
because let's be honest, the original trilogy is great, but like technology didn't allow for great.
The only great lightsaber fight in the original trilogy, in my opinion, is Jedi.
Yep, exactly.
Luke versus Vader and Jedi, especially when Luke just goes off on him.
Yes.
And knocks his hand off. It's like Luke was a character that I struggled to identify with when I was a kid until that moment.
Until that movie.
Yeah, exactly. I was always a Han Solo guy.
Because, like,
yeah,
we could get into a whole episode to, like, explaining why I like Return of the Jedi better than Empire. But, like, Luke is an infinitely more interesting character when he is burdened with expectation.
Mm-hmm.
And once he has been through the training from Yoda and understands he's all they got. And also understanding now who his father was and everything he has to live up to. When he reappears in Return of the Jedi, it's almost like he's a completely different character. And he's infinitely more interesting.
Here's another thing. Jedi is also the only of the original trilogy that is actually enhanced by watching the prequels.
Right.
Because of what happens to Anakin and the parallel with what is going on with Luke.
That's
and
why
Palpatine's
I think it's called
puppeteering.
Machete Order advocates, because if you're showing it to like my kids for the first time whenever they get to watch it, you can't show them in chronological order because that removes all the impact from the Luke from the I Am Your Father twist. So the Machete Order says show 4, 5, then take a break and go back and show 1, 2, 3, and then come back to 6, and then 6 plays much better as like this climax, this finale to not just 4 and 5, but the 6 movies as a whole.
And should have been the finale of the Skywalker saga. But that's another story for another time.
Anyway, I interrupted
I'm
you.
Gonna, I'm gonna give
so you had episode one at
the
bottom.
Episode two right above that.
Yep.
Last Jedi right above that, which I know will stir some feathers here. But I have not seen Solo, for the record. So then what would be next would probably be Rise of Skywalker just above Last Jedi for me. And then I go Force Awakens above that.
Okay.
Slightly. It's tough, close between those two.
So we're down to the same top five. It's just a matter of which order.
Of the order that I have them in. And I will go... let me go... This is tough. This is really tough. Let me go Sith. No, let me go Rogue One, Sith, A New Hope, Empire, and Jedi at the very top. And yes, we could do a podcast, and perhaps should one day, on why we have the controversial opinion that Jedi is better than Empire. It is a controversial opinion, and certainly that's no knock on Empire, which is fantastic. But
one thing every Star Wars fan should do if you haven't had the opportunity to do it is, one, rewatch Rogue One and be reminded how fucking phenomenal
it
is.
Amazing, yeah.
And if you have time, watch Rogue One and then immediately pop in Episode 4.
Mm-hmm.
Mind-blowing, and makes Rogue One even better in that context.
And I should mention also, when talking about Sith being above Rogue One on my list, Rogue One is actually a better movie. Like, as far as like making a movie, like the technical aspect, you don't have the green screen stuff that's kind of distracting at times. However, Episode 3, for a Star Wars fan, for me, is a slightly more rewarding movie because
it gives visual to events that we had been forced to like imagine in our heads for years, and for the most part is really satisfying in doing so.
And also key here, imagination. It is so creative with the worlds and the planets and the creatures.
The only
and the,
like
the fight scenes
thing
and
that holds that movie back, besides the dialogue, and I get it, the prequel dialogue. No point in getting into that. Lucas was so in love with green screen by that point. Like, yeah. If you could just take a few scenes in that movie and put them on practical sets with practical effects.
Force Awakens or Last Jedi or Rise of Skywalker.
That approach.
Sensibilities.
Yes, with that story.
With and you're looking at the best Star Wars movie, probably, yes. For my money.
Yes.
But there are so many highs in that. And in addition to featuring amazing action, the best action scenes, by the way, of any Star Wars movie. But in addition to that, it does feature the a top, I'm going to say without trying to be hyperbolic, a top five all-time Star Wars scene for me, which is the opera scene of Palpatine and Anakin, which if you had one scene from the prequels to explain how Anakin Skywalker becomes Darth Vader, that's it would it. Be that scene. So that's why it ranks so – one of the reasons it ranks so highly for me.
There you go.
But nonetless, Star Wars. There's our we turned this into.
We've counted down everything there is to count.
Countdown, and we're done, folks. We'll be back next week to continue Arrow Month. What will we have coming your way? We're not going to tell you just yet. We're going to figure it out and bring you some more hot, piping hot Arrow takes into the next week. So thanks a lot, gang.
Our traveling fanboys. Consideration paid for by the following.
Place Nations, JT Rosero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have over 24 podcasts available on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceNation.com. We now offer them to you on two great feeds. On the Place Nation Wrestling feed, we dive into topics running the gamut from today's WWE to the glory days of yesteryear and the ins and outs of the territory days. In addition to our full-length shows, we also deliver to you special pod blasts on topics old and new.
The Place to Be Nation Pop Feed is a veritable treasure trove of great content, offering tremendous shows covering the land of movies, television, life, comics, and sports, brought to you by the most knowledgeable and insightful folks in the podcast world.
You can find all these great shows, plus archives of our past podcasts from over the past 8 years, as well by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while you're there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All of these shows, plus others, available on PlaceMination.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth stretch projects, and much more. Be sure to support our site by using www.PlaceMination.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping. We want to thank our friends at Boneheads, Wing Bar, ProWrestlingOnly.com, and TheHistoryOfWrestling.com as well. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr. PlaceMination.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.